Couple weeks ago, my publisher sent me this book in the mail, and I put it to the side. I was busy doing other things. At the same time, I was putting together this Titan video, and I've done Titan presentations in the past, the Wars of the Titans and the Giants. I read this book in one sitting. It is that profound. This book is amazing. We have so many things to share from this book. The story of the ancient Titan race and the offspring of the giants. Gaia's war, the mother goddess, Mother Earth, however you want to call her, her war against Zeus, the goddess and her offspring, the ancient cataclysm that destroyed the world before Tartarus, the mysteries of the four rivers of Hades and the underworld, and their connection to the four rivers of Eden, ancient knowledge of a subterranean race, the wars of the Titans and the giants. I can just go on. Amazing revelation of how the Phoenix came into existence. Pandora's box. Guys, I'm bewildered that I had never heard of this book, because this author pulled all this data that I was just talking about from different sources, and I'm going to read them to you. At the end of this presentation is another section where I'm going to read whole passages out of this book, because they're unbelievable about the underworld and how different races in the past had to go down there because they were at war with another race on the surface. Blew my mind after looking at all this information, knowing everything that I already know, and I've presented to you guys about underground races and how they have technology very far superior to our own on the surface world, how the elite families are divided among themselves. It's all told in the Greek legends of the Titans and the giants. This guy puts it together so incredible. It gives an entirely new meaning to the passage in the New Testament that says that Jesus descended into hell, into Hades. That's the Greek word. And Hades was a real place in the underworld. Yeah, it's a place where a civilization thrived. It's a place that was known by its four rivers. And it's a place that an entire race was banished from. And their banishment and curse was that they had to leave paradise and go to the surface and work and toil and slave for their existence and their food. We're gonna get into this presentation. You gotta make it through the presentation on the Titans and the Giants, guys. Because at the end, I'm reading whole passages out of this book. You can't miss out on that. In numerous presentations of mine, I've explained to you guys about these intermediate periods that scholars like to throw in our history books. We need to call them what they really are. There are several of them. They're intermediate periods for the Hittites, for the Amorites, for the Assyrians. There are intermediate periods for the Egyptians. Two Egyptians have three of them. There are intermediate periods for the Greeks. These intermediate periods are a very clever way that scholarship hides resets. I have investigated many of them. One of the major ones for the Western world that I have told you guys about in numerous presentations is the Great Mediterranean Dark Age that lasted 350 years. We're going to start with that here, because as soon as that 350-year period was ending, that's when we have the rise of Hesiod, who wrote Works and Days, and Theogony, and we have the rise of Homer and later Greek historians and mythographers like Theognis, and there's so many of them after that. But the first ones are the ones we're going to focus on here, because I've been telling you guys in multiple presentations that the stories that we're getting from the ancient world were coming through more primitive filters, and that people who had lost their infrastructures were attempting to convey more advanced materials to us, but they only could do so from their present frames of reference. These are people who lived centuries after more sophisticated civilizations that had totally collapsed. And this is what we find with the Great Mediterranean Dark Age. I'm not going into the details of what caused that Dark Age in this video. I have multiple videos about that. Marquesas veterans, you already know. This is an advanced video. You already know it was a phoenix phenomenon, 1135 BC, Pharaoh Sekhnakhti. You know the Tewathidae Danann, all the history is attached. The founding of the Olmecs from the Chinese Mandate in Heaven that changed, and 250,000 Chinese got in ships and they had to flee their country. It was a change of government, or they were going to face genocide. They appeared in Central America as the Olmeca. You already know this is 1135 BC. Phoenix wiped out almost the entire Mediterranean, sent them on a reset that was so terrible. It took over 3 centuries for that area of the world to start waking back up. The problem we have is the traditions, the myths, the legends, the lore, the fables, the historical accounts, records, anecdotes, everything that we have preserved about what the world was like before that Dark Age is coming from people who preserved information after that Dark Age. So we're going to go through that information. I'm going to go through it as they conveyed it, and then I'm going to explain, and you're going to see it yourself, what they're really explaining and what they're really telling us happened in the ancient world. So Homer and Hesiod are our principal authorities for basically the unfolding of events in the ancient world. Everybody after them was copying them in some way or another, or using basically their information and then adding new information from other ancillary sources. So what we have between Homer and Hesiod is an explanation that basically the Greek world began with the reign of Kronos, and that's a problem. The reason it's a problem is because they admit that Kronos was at the very end of the Age of the Titans. So we have this vast epic of history for which we have almost no data. And it was a realm of the Titans. And the Greeks admit that the Titans were before regular humans. And that there is a race between them with some overlap called the Gigantes, the Giants. So about 95% of everything we know about the Age of the Titans is in the reign of Kronos, which is a very, very short period of time. It's basically an admission that 95% of the histories of the Titans is unknown. But what we uncover in all these Greek legends and myths that give us all these little anecdotes about why things happened the way they did and these little side references about Titans in ancient times, we put together this fascinating picture. That's what we're going to do in this video and explain what it means to our future, what it meant to them about our future, because it's all relative. So the rise of Kronos being the youngest of the Titans, it was a golden age, because Hesiod divides the history of the world into 5 ages. We're in the 5th age now, which is not dissimilar from the Aztec stone of the 5th sun, which is not even Aztec, it's Toltec, but I'm just giving you what the academics call it. But the Toltec stone of the 5th sun, or also called the Aztec calendar stone, it also itemizes 5 ages. So Hesiod, he says that during the golden age of Kronos, men did not have to work and toil for the ground. Food was aplenty. It was all over the place. Men lived in absolute peace, and they even interacted with the gods. Hesiod kind of confuses us because he interchanges gods and titans often, only when he's talking about this golden age. So men lived among the gods, and he also says men lived among the titans. But we do have references to gods who were not titans. We'll get to that. So the golden age basically ends, and we enter the silver age. In the silver age, all of a sudden, Hesiod says that men would only live as children to 100 years. So this is spoken from the perspective of titans,
Because a titan would have looked down and thought that someone who lived 100 years was just a child. But to humans, it was a long time. So, humans in the Silver Age, they didn't pay tribute to the gods. They entered quarrels with each other and with the gods. And basically, humans were seeking a better world. They wanted to build things for themselves. They had seen what their betters had, and they wanted it too. But Zeus looked down and did not like this development at all. We're going to go into some detail about Zeus. He's not who you think he is. He's been painted by the mythographers as the great all-father, as the great powerful god, the benevolent god, all these things. He's not. Believe me, Zeus is just like that thing that jumped out of a burning bush. Zeus is pathological. So Zeus sees what's happening, and he sends Typhon, unleashes this beast on the ancient world. And I'm going to give you descriptions of Typhon. My archaic veterans, you already know Typhon is Typhine, which is the phoenix. But Zeus, he kills them all. Now, we already know there were some survivors, but he kills them all. And then Typhon plays hero and then chases, I mean, Zeus plays hero and chases Typhon off. So this is what introduced the ancient Bronze Age, according to Hesiod and Homer and the later mythographers. So the Bronze Age, during this period, men became tough. They're post-cataclysmic. They have lost their whole prior world of peace. And now they all they know is warfare and violence. And for this is post-diluvian. Typhon caused a flood the entire world. So this you know the same story from the Bible. So this whole era is what has confused many mythographers, because they're not aware that we have a Gihon flood before the great flood of Noah, then we have the great flood of Noah, and then after that, we have the Ogygian flood. All three of these floods I've given many, many details about in the Archaics presentations, as well as a couple presentations on the capture of Luna, the moon flood that was before all of them. So we have here with the Ogygian flood, we have the end of the Bronze Age. And we know that this was 552 years after the flood of Noah, which was 2239 BC. So the Greek traditions are following the historical template for which we have seen archaics unveil. It's all chronologically perfect. The Greeks had basically understood exactly how the ancient world unfolded. They just didn't understand why. And they didn't understand or see clearly what had happened on the other side of that great flood cataclysm. So the 1687 BC Ogygian deluge was, in the Greek mind, this is the Kraken. The Kraken appears released by Poseidon. Poseidon is a unique god, because Poseidon is the god of the sea. However, he's also the god of earthquakes, which is ironic. So the god of the sea, who dwells in the sea, is actually in charge of earthquakes on land. Now, 1687 BC, we understand, because Poseidon worship was prevalent throughout the entire Mediterranean at that period of time. And sacrifices to Poseidon at that period of time was by poisoning or drugging a female, this is Andromeda, and putting them on an altar. And then the priest would put a living giant squid on the face of the sacrificial victim. And the squid, the squid's tentacles would rise. And the squid, if you don't know, a squid has a beak. And its beak is underneath the deal. And it would literally eat the face off of the sacrificial victim. Yeah, guy, this is not a kid's video. So the face of the sacrificial victim would be eaten off while they were alive. But they're drugged and they can't move. And this was absolutely necessary, because they could have chained somebody down and done it against their will. But that's not how the institution of human sacrifice worked back then. It had to be a willing victim. And in order to promote that illusion, the priesthood drugged their victims so that the people that were observing the sacrifice actually thought that the victim was a hero instead of a victim. Because a drugged, they couldn't struggle, and it didn't look like to fight back. Because if it was perceived that a person did not want to sacrifice themselves, then it was already known that when they went through the gates to the other side, that they would report that to the gods, and then the gods would not accept that as a sacrifice, and instead they would send something like a kraken. So this was the ancient Mediterranean mindset of the Poseidon worshippers. So this is where we get Medusa from. And Perseus, who is the destroyer, he comes, he fights the Kraken during a sun-darkening episode and saves the city of Argos after Joppa is flooded by the ocean and earthquakes. So all this is 1687 BC. This is the Greek mythology preserves many of the elements of actual historical event. So, and all these are covered in prior presentations. But Hesiod does something that's very interesting. He introduces a heroic age, and there are several other models that are published by the mythographers that do not include this. But Hesiod's is the oldest, and it includes this heroic age that later Greek authors didn't. They just had four ages. Hesiod had five. Now, in my prior presentations, I've explained to you guys that the vapor canopy came back for a short period of time after 1687 BC. This is the Avellino eruption. It's recorded by scientists. It's dated precisely. And we had a dust veil enshroud the entire world for 25 years. This almost caused a vapor canopy to come back. And conditions from volcanism and a change in atmospheric pressure actually created changes in the human genome to where people were growing to extraordinary sizes. Hesiod documents this. This is exactly what was going on in the pre-flood world to create what were later called titans. People were growing. And I've told you in prior videos that from published books, I have found data about scientists who grew 2 inches in 1902, which is a phoenix year, just because they were exposed to ambient radiation at Mount Paley after it exploded on Martinique. So putting all these things together, nothing here is unbelievable. So 25-year darkness. During that 25-year darkness, any humans born at that period of time grew to astonishing sizes. But after that 25-year darkness dispelled, this is precisely when academics right now today claim that the ancient world started waking up in 640 BC. Yeah, there's many, many academic papers that have been written on this phenomenon saying that something terrible had happened in the ancient world, and around 640 or 650 BC, it seemed like all the civilizations around the world were starting to wake up at the same time from a long slumber. And they're absolutely correct. They just don't know why. This is all preserved in Chronicon. You want to know why? Read Chronicon or watch my videos. I go into a lot of detail about the Ogygian Deluge. So we enter the Heroic Age, and the Heroic Age is fantastic because we have all these things that are very well preserved in the Greek text. I have them all itemized. This Heroic Age is right after the Ogygian Deluge. So sea crops, this is the time when sea crops appears and Danaus appears, basically the progenitor of the Danaan. And sea crops comes from Egypt. He brings a fleet from Egypt and inhabits the Peloponnesus, Boeotia. And so does Cadmus, but Cadmus doesn't come by way of Egypt. Cadmus appears in ancient Greece with a huge fleet from Phoenicia, from the Canaanite coasts. Danaus escapes Egypt with a fleet. They're called the people of the goddess Danu. Other people call them the Danaan. Now, in ancient Ireland, after a phoenix cataclysm in 1135 BC, they're called the Tuatha De Danann, and they defeat the race of giants called the Firbolgs over basically an ancient contest for who's going to rule Ireland. So these, right after this episode, during the Age of Heroes, after this miniature vapor canopy, after this Ogygian conflict, and it's a war and a flood, after all this, we have all these patriarchs from other areas of the world in the Mediterranean all coming to the Aegean, and they're setting up civilizations and cities in all these places. And this is interesting because in the Greek texts, I have recorded this in Chronicon for you guys, but we have specific mentionings that after this Ogygian deluge, the Peloponnesus, Boeotia, and the Aegean area itself was completely without a soul remaining for 189 years because the entire area after the Ogygian deluge was not habitable. And this is exactly in the chronological traditions that we have, the arrival of the Danaan and the arrival of the Phoenicians at Cadmus and the arrival of the Libyans and Egyptians from the lower Egypt coming by way of Egypt all the way across the Mediterranean to colonize this area of the Peloponnesus. So this is Greek mythology is absolutely supported by the historical record in concerning these events. But this is the Age of Heroes, and the Age of Heroes also gave rise to the tradition of Atreus. For those of you who have followed my phoenix research, you will know that in 1273 BC, which is a phoenix year, two brothers in Argos were contending for the throne. In that contention, one of them claimed to be a master swordsman and a hero, and he was going to use that to swoon the people. But Atreus was an astronomer, and he told the people at such and such time, this year, the sun is going to darken. And they didn't believe him. But when it happened, they saw him as something supernatural. He was an astronomer. He knew the phoenix was coming. Same thing Thales of Miletus did in 585 BC when he predicted the sun darkening in 583 BC. It wasn't the moon. It was something else that darkened the sun. Atreus did that, and they awarded him the kingship of Argos. So this was during the Age of Heroes. Now, right after that, I'm talking within a decade after that, we have the famous story of Jason and the Argonauts. This is not mythology, guys. It's been turned into mythology by this real simplified way of conveying information because their infrastructure had collapsed. Sounds like children's tales to us today, but the geographical areas that are mentioned in the Jason and the Argonauts tale have been verified by scholars that this must have been an actual legitimate naval voyage that was just shocking for that time period. So Jason and the Argonauts, right after that, during the Age of Heroes, we have this major conflict. It was inevitable. It's called the Seven Against Thebes. The Thebes is the Greek city of Thebes. And the reason this conflict was inevitable is because this is the pre-Greek people, but it's the area of Greece today. But we have a major population of Amuru, Westerners. We have a major population that came by way of Egypt. We have a major population of Canaanite Phoenicians. And we have a major population of Danaan. These were Mediterranean, almost international mariners, a mariner race. They were all over the place in the ancient world. But these Danaan, all three of them were in the same geographical area. Now, overlay these three large colonies in the area of Greece with the indigenous Achaeans and then the local people of Argos and the descendant and the rising empire of Mycenae. All this is in the same area. It's a huge melting pot. So it created a lot of sociopolitical problems. And one of those was the famous battle called the Seven Against Thebes. Thebes was a city with seven gates, and seven different armies were assigned to assail each of the gates of Thebes. But this conflict went over and it passed, but things did not get better because we have a conflict, a trade war that involved the Sea People's Confederation. It was a trade war involving Libya and Egypt, the Black Sea coast, and that's dead center of controversy for this new trade war was the Kingdom of Ilium. Their capital city was Tros. Now, Tros has passed down to us as Troy. This was the War of Ilium. It was the Battle of Troy, the Trojan War. It lasted. It was a 10-year long conflict. Now, the Age of Heroes pretty much comes to an end in 1229 BC when Troy falls. So we have different groups now migrating to different areas, and a large group of Trojan survivors got in fleets, and they left to different points and ended up in Italy, Italia, among the Etruscans and the Sabines. So you already know who those people became later. But we're going to stick to the Greeks, not the Latins. So anyway, as all this is going on, this age of heroes is very well documented by the Greeks. Now, of course, it's in mythological overtones, but we basically see the socio-political unfolding of all kinds of interesting events, and we'll get into that more. But this 1135 BC Phoenix event that I mentioned earlier with Pharaoh Senecti and the Olmeca and the Chinese, this is what started the 350-year Dark Age in the Mediterranean. Nothing. We have no records. Humanity went dark after 1135 BC. So, and in the biblical narrative, it's also dark. As a matter of fact, a lot of biblical scholars believe that Hebrew writers invented the ages of the judges because they needed to fill a historical void, and that didn't actually happen. These stories were borrowed, like Samson and holding the two pillars and all that. Same thing Hercules did. They believe a lot of these stories were borrowed from older Canaanite and older sources, like Ugaritic and tales from Rashamra. Much of the Old Testament comes from Ugaritic cuneiform text and Rashamric text. So anyway, that's northern Syria. Neither here nor there, we've gone full circle now to the 350-year Dark Age. 350 years is a very long period of time to not have any preservation of written materials. And then to have two men surface later, 350 years after this Dark Age began, two men surface and give us their versions of the history of the world that happened prior to that 350 years. It's like me 80 or 90 years in the future writing a documentary about the Civil War without having any source materials about the Civil War. You got to understand, guys, they were recording what people were passing down by word of mouth. So from the beginning of Hesiod's account of the ages of man and the fall of the Titans, this is where we enter the Iron Age. Hesiod believed that he was living at the beginning of the Iron Age. And that's really interesting. He lived about, 800 BC when he wrote Theogony and Works and Days. So the Iron Age is one of absolute war, dissolution, destruction. Mankind is not happy. They will always be in contention with each other. And the gods have absolutely abandoned the human race. This is the Iron Age. This is the age that Hesiod believes that we are in today. So, that's neither here nor there, but it's very interesting. But this age literally began and ended with Typhon. So we need to discuss Typhon for a minute here. So, listen. We began and ended this small narrative right here leading up to the preservation of all these traditions with Typhon. The Phoenix began the destruction, and it ended this period, which was the beginning of a 350-year hiatus, a complete dark age. So Typhon, according to the ancient Greeks, was so feared that when he attacked, the gods themselves always fled to Egypt. This is a data point you need to remember. So, Phoenix was winged, or depicted with wings, and was so huge that when he appeared, it looked like his head brushed the stars. Typhon was married to Echidna, who was considered to be the mother of all monsters. Typhon's history, according to Hesiod, was one of always working up mischief among the human race. But Typhon had a child. Typhon's child was the Sphinx. This is what the Greeks believed. So the Sphinx could be approached, but if you approached the Sphinx, so apparently it was at a place that was sacred. If you approached the Sphinx, it would ask you a riddle, and you could live if you could answer that riddle. But one day, it asked Oedipus a riddle, and Oedipus answered it correctly, and the Sphinx was so destitute that somebody actually outsmarted it, that the Sphinx, which is typified as a female, drowned herself. Well, I'm telling you now, guys, the memory of the Greeks knowing that the Sphinx was drowned is another data point. I have three or four videos that explain that the North African plate suffered an earthquake in 2239 BC, and it lowered its subsidence. And this is the reason why the Great Pyramids were underwater for 340 years. So, and if the pyramids were halfway underwater, then the Sphinx was totally underwater. But that's neither here nor there. So, in Hesiod's Theogony and Works and Days, he goes into detail about the Titans and the origin of the Titans, but this is where we come across some very intriguing information. We find out that the origin of the Titans themselves, for which we don't have hardly any historical details, was Gaia and Uranus. This is Mother Earth and Father Sky, or you can call him Heaven. So basically, Hesiod and Homer are conveying to us that the origin of the race that precedes mankind before this great flood was they were born from two concepts, because these weren't people. They're not gods. Mother Earth and Father Sky were not Titans. They're something else. And they're described as concepts. So we have So heaven and earth as concepts. They gave birth to the Titans, who were predecessors of mankind. This pretty much begs us to itemize these Titans and see what we know about each one of them, and maybe even learn what the translation of their actual name or title is, to see where we're going with this. So I've provided this list right here. And it's very interesting that two concepts gave birth to 12 Titans. But there's over 30 Titans mentioned in throughout all the mythographers. We can count about 32, 33, 34 Titans. If there's more, I missed them, and so did a lot of other people. But there's different ways to say it, Okeanos or Oceanus. This Titan was basically the ocean. It's very easy to figure out. And Tethys, his consort, means nurse or grandmother, and she's over all fresh water. Then we have Hyperion. Hyperion, I'm going to go through this list pretty fast. Hyperion, he goes before the sun. That's the translation of his name, and he's a god of light and observation. Again, concepts. Best known for fathering the sun, the moon, and the dawn. Now, we have Asteria. This is a female. It means of the stars. She was the goddess of nocturnal oracles and shooting stars. This is phenomena. Then we have Astraeus. Astraeus is just the male counterpart of Asteria. Astraeus means starry. He was a Titan god. He was just a Titan god of the starry night sky. But with him we have Creus, which is the ram. And according to the mythographers, Creus typifies the constellations. I believe Aries is the first constellation, or was during the Greek times, and his name means ram. Clymene was a Titan goddess. She is the goddess of renown, fame, and infamy. These are concepts. Mnemosyne, I think her name is Mnemosyne, starts with an M, but it's Mnemosyne, the goddess of memory. She is also the mother of the nine muses. Yapatos. We know who Yapatos is in the Bible. They call him Japheth. But Yapatos is the wanderer. He is the god of death or of mortal life in the Greek pantheon. And Thea is goddess of sun and light. And Re is flow or ease and a goddess of fertility. And Themis is the goddess of divine order and law. Now, Phoebe means bright. It's a goddess. Phoebe means bright or pure. She's the goddess of prophecy and intellect. Coeus is the goddess of inquiry, wisdom, oracles, and foresight. Kronos, the god of time. Atlas means to carry. He was a titan, to endure. He was condemned to carry the heavens. Prometheus, who we're about to go into. Prometheus is forethought. For giving fire to humanity, he was sentenced to eternal torment by Zeus. Of course, he was later saved by Hercules. Hercules saved a lot of people. He was one of the more prestigious. Hercules was one of the more prestigious passengers on the Argo with Jason and the Argonauts, until he started getting out of control and they left him behind on an island one time. Prometheus' brother was Epimetheus, something like that. Yeah, Epimetheus, afterthought. Epimetheus, afterthought. He received Pandora as a gift from the gods. We're going to get into that. I'm going to bypass that right now because we're going to move into that. You guys are going to have to understand how Pandora fits into this whole non-history of the world before the cataclysm. So Eurynome was a titan goddess. Styx was a titan goddess who typified a river in the underworld. I don't know if this is Hecate or Hecate, but it means goddess of death, goddess of the underworld, far-reaching is how her name translates. Then we have Ophion. Ophion was an elder titan in Greek. And if I remember correctly, Ophion was also, I don't remember his consort, but Ophion was the one that was basically deposed when Kronos took the throne. So his wife is Eurynome. E-U-R-Y-N-O-M-E, Eurynome. Wow. All right. And Kronos' wife was, okay. Well, then we have some minor titans. These were all not original titans. These titans were the last of their line before the cataclysm. This was Metis, which means cunning. Dione, which means divine or goddess. Helios, the sun. This is very interesting. Remember, guys, I've showed you several times Sumerian and Egyptian traditions that reveal that the sun, Shamash, Utu, Osiris, Horus, they came very, very late in the creation pantheons because under the vapor canopy world of the pre-cataclysmic time period, the sun was unknown. It was lunar-based timekeeping, and it was stellar systems, and the sun couldn't be seen because of the vapor canopy. The vapor canopy by day prevented somebody from seeing the sun at daytime. And then every single night, a mist watered the entire world in the evening and the morning. And the evening and the morning was the next day. It was a day count system during the vapor canopy. At nighttime, the vapor canopy turned the mesosphere into a magnifying glass. And this is why the ancients in the pre-flood world could see the heavens like they could touch the stars. It magnified everything. But during the daytime, with the sun on the outside of the vapor canopy, they had a problem. It turned it dark purple, opaque. This is why the ancients described the sky as a dark purple light by day. And it was actually brighter at night than it was in the daytime because the moon totally lit up the entire world. So Helios came very late in even the Greek. So now we have Egyptian, we have the Sumerian version, and now we have the Greek version where the sun came very last in the creative deal, which is totally opposite of what you would think. And it's because of the vapor canopy. Selene appears, the moon. Eos appears, the dawn. Titaness, she was a goddess of the dawn, sister of the sun and moon. Eurybia means far ruling. It's a concept, mastery over the seas. Pallas is the brandisher or maiden. This is a titan of warcraft. I guess it's a titaness of warcraft. Persis is the destroyer. from which we get Perseus. But at this time, Perseus was a titan. Leto, the unseen, a goddess. Menoetius is doomed might, another concept. And then we have Lelantos. Very unusual name for a titan, but Lelantos actually means something that goes unobserved. So we've gone through this list of the titans, about over 30 names and the meaning of their names and basically what they represented to the ancient Greeks. But we have absolutely almost no history about any of these individuals. So the titans don't seem to be memories of individuals. They seem to be concepts that were remembered. And we'll get into that. So, what we have with Gaia and Arinos are two concepts, the earth and heavens. But this is what we have in the Egyptian, in the pre-Aeneid pantheon as well. We have the watery nun, a chaos, the same thing we find in the Near East, in the Akkadian, the Assyrian, the Babylonian Tiamat, waters of chaos, which all stem from the An and the Ki of the Sumerian pantheons. An, A-N, is heaven. K-I is earth. So this is where we get the term Anunnaki, lords of heaven and earth, or gods of heaven and earth, which is what the Babylonians depicted them as. So we don't have a difference here. The Greeks are basically confirming the exact same thing the Phoenicians believe, the Egyptians believe, and all the Near Eastern cultures I just mentioned believe, all the way back to Sumer. They believe the same thing. Everything came out of a chaos, and out of this chaos was born two concepts, and these two concepts were earth and heaven. And then following that were 12 mighty titans who themselves gave birth to 12 more titans who themselves gave birth. Their grandchildren were scattered all the way till we have a pantheon of about 34, 35 titans. So this is we're not seeing anything different. They just say it in very different ways that the Greeks did. But this is what we find in Genesis as well. Biblical scholars have always known that in Genesis chapter 1, the creation of our world was out of a watery deep, a watery chaos. It's described that way. Before the sun, the moon, the stars, before animals, before humans, before anything, it was a great watery chaos, and the Spirit of God hovered over the waters of the deep. And the word for waters in Genesis is Tiham. Tiham is a word in Hebrew derived straight from Tihum, which is Babylonian, comes from Tiamat, the seven-headed goddess of chaos. So we have here the same thing Sankuniathan said, the ancient Phoenician chronicler 1000 BC who wrote A History of the World. He too describes this great watery dragon that gave birth to the heavens and the earth, and seven-headed dragon of chaos that the Babylonian Tiamat is a perfect description of, which is what we get from the Atrahasis epic, the Enuma Elish, seven tablets of Babylonian creation. It's all very specific. Here we have the Greeks saying almost the same thing. This is intriguing because with all these different cultures basically telling us that the beginning of the world started with a violent, dark, seven-headed dragon of chaos, we cannot help but look to the future when we see the exact same imagery found only in the book of Revelation, describing events in the apocalypse before a new heavens and a new earth are created. This is all very clear in the book of Revelation. So, this chaos, it is a destruction. This is not just a singular event that all different cultures trace their histories back to, this one darkness, dark world. No, that is a result of something bad that had happened. And this is what scholars have determined about Genesis chapter 1 and Genesis chapter 2. They're of the opinion that something terrible happened between Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, and verse 2. Some scholars have even called it gap theory. meaning there's a vast amount of time that fits in here that we don't know anything about. But we can see from all these other biblical passages, like Jeremiah chapter 4, which describes the only other place in the Old Testament where this Tiham is described, is right there. And it says the birds have fled from the sky and the cities are laid waste. And biblical scholars are pretty much convinced this passage in Jeremiah chapter 4 is attempting to fill in that area right there, describing that the creation of our world, according to the book of Genesis, is actually our world waking up after it has been completely destroyed. And this is what we're finding right here in the Greek legends of the Titans. So, this isn't my point to this video, but it's just an interesting tangent. So, something had happened bad. Something so terrible that according to the Greek mythographers, Mother Earth herself schemed against Father Heaven. And Gaia, she instigated a rebellion, and she wired up the Titans, her children, she wired up the Titans to rebel against Ouranos. You know Ouranos as Uranus. So this great rebellion was started by the Great Mother. She wired up the Titans to do this because, this is a key, it's another data point, the rebellion was specifically induced because Father Heaven had done something that forced the Titans to retreat to the underworld to survive. It's called Tartarus, and it's another clue as to what really unfolded in the ancient world. Tartarus is a unique word. It's a compound. Tar means west, but when you would double that, word up in ancient Greek, Tartar means west. Tartarus actually means the far west, but all the descriptions of Tartarus are in the underworld. So I need you to remember now. Remember, guys, if you're not following me, it's because listen, this video was for Archaic's veterans, so you're going to understand what I'm about to say right now concerning Tartarus and the need to go hide in the underworld from something that was coming from the heavens. Remember, guys, remember in 3439 BC, the appearance of the Anunna for the first time in the old world, they came from the ancient Americas. They came from the West. Remember, I've told you guys many times, the Sea People's Confederation. When the Sea Peoples came, it wasn't because they wanted to come over here and play. They weren't trying to vacation. They came in fleets because they were trying to survive. They were fleeing cataclysm in America, and they flooded the Mediterranean, and they attacked everybody looking for a homeland. This was the Sea People's Federation. They came from the West. Also, the Amuru, when they flooded the Near East and they occupied Mari and Mitanni and they took over the dynasties of Hattusis, the Hittites, and Lydia, later Lydia, they took over all of Kadesh, northern Syria. They set up a dynasty in Egypt. It was called the Shepherd Kings. When these Amuru came in, all other nations feared them. They were a unique people, highly advanced, very, very knowledgeable, had technology that was surpassing anything that they had experienced before, and it's what allowed such a small nation to come in and take everybody over. The Amuru are specifically called thousands of times in cuneiform texts. They are called Westerners. Their origin was a mystery. In the Bible, they're called Amorites. These were the Amuru. In ancient Egyptian temple reliefs that show pictures of them, they are two heads taller than anybody else in Egyptian reliefs at the Temple of Karnak. And they're called the Tamahu. Same thing as the Amuru. They're called the Tamahu. The Tamahu were considered gigantic by normal standards and very sophisticated and very feared. So, but there were Westerners. So, well, what we have here is we have the admission. We have the admission that somewhere in the West, something so terrible happened that came from the sky that that civilization had to seek out an underworld area. And they blame God for that. And after that destruction was over, their own area was not habitable, so they went east. Remember the Tower of Babel story? All the people who came to build the Tower of Babel came from the east. That means they were in the west. So this is a... So I have to ask. What could have happened in the past that was so catastrophic that it would have required a whole civilization to bed down underground and not come up for a while, and then when they came up, seek out an entire different hemisphere to colonize? I already know. You already know. My RK's veterans already know. We already know what the Phoenix phenomenon has done in ancient times. This is the story of the Titans. This is what the Greeks were trying to convey. The concepts of what was going on is found in the translations of the Titans' names. The individual Titans' titles and names give us more and more details as to what the Greeks are trying to convey. You got to understand how difficult it was for a people to convey information over a 3-century-long hiatus, when education and knowledge and writing, everything had collapsed. So people are passing all these stories down by word of mouth over this time period. So what we're left with is not actual histories as far chronologically arranged, Titans actually being real persons and people. What we're left with is survivors who are preserving concepts that have been turned into personalities. This is what we have. And the Greeks aren't the only ones to do this. So, the key to understanding this unremembered past of the Greek mythographers is we have to understand the few stories about Titans that were preserved. There's not much. We don't need to go into Kronos. Almost all the stories preserved about the Titans are Kronos, the last of the Titans, who actually became the king over the Titans and ruled until the Golden Age collapsed. That's the very end of Titan history. But the beginning of Titan history started with Prometheus and Pandora. This is the key to understanding what happened in the ancient world and what the Greeks are trying to tell us in all their traditions and myths, and how it applies to us today. What it means for us today. Prometheus looked down upon mankind and he realized, man, this is not good. Ordinary humans didn't fare as good as we did through this cataclysmic episode. When the Titans came back from Tartarus, an underground place in the far west, when they returned, they found the state of humans in the Mediterranean, Africa, the Near East, India, Asia. They found them pitiful. Neolithic, living as animals and beasts and naked, and they realize it's terrible. So Prometheus was a benefactor, and according to the Greek legends and myths, he gave mankind fire. Now, this offended Zeus. In the traditions, they try to paint Zeus as a very patriarchal, like a good benevolent deity who just had anger management issues. But it's worse than that. Zeus was not a benevolent god. He was a liar. He was a womanizer. He had no problems issuing curses, eternal damning, condemning people for eternity. He had no problem doing any of this, changing people from humans into animals, transforming humans into monsters. Zeus, you can lay all that to his charge. He did all that. And yet he's supposed to be the great god. Now, he also demonized those who tried to benefit humans. This is what Zeus did. So Zeus Prometheus saw this. He saw what was going on and secretly started benefiting humanity. And one of the greatest things Prometheus gave humanity, according to the traditions, is fire. But remember, guys, these are traditions passed through many filters after several resets and collapses. Fire is very important to a simplified Neolithic style living people. But what's being conveyed here is something else. Fire is very important to people to survive when they're at their base level of infrastructure. What's really being conveyed here is that he gave humanity something very important, or Zeus would have not have been so offended. Given mankind fire wouldn't have set Zeus off, because Zeus completely, eternally condemned Prometheus. Not only condemned him and banished him, but also to eternal torture of having an animal eat his liver out every single day, and his liver would grow back. Remember vapor canopy conditions, guys? I told you guys that open wounds heal within minutes and hours. Atmospheric pressure, the oxygen density, vitamin and mineral richness. The vapor canopy world was nothing like the world we live in today. This is why the story of Cain and Abel is so important. It never happened. There was no Cain. There was no Abel. But this is a story that typifies the murder of a man, of somebody during the vapor canopy periods was terrible. It was horrific. It's too hard to accidentally kill somebody in a vapor canopy. They're already healing as soon as you hit them. So to kill somebody during vapor canopy conditions means that you really wanted them dead and you had to work for it. So that's the story of Cain and Abel. But here it is with Prometheus too. Prometheus preserves another element of vapor canopy techniques. The fact that Titans healed within minutes or hours or even days. Because as soon as he was healed, this damn animal would appear again and start, while he was chained to a rock, would sit there and eat out his liver again while he was alive. Okay, this is torture, and this is from Zeus. Because this individual, Prometheus, chose to indulge a secret to mankind. We're going to get to that. So, that's my Prometheus notes. Zeus, you would think that eternal torture and imprisonment would be enough, but it's not. The very fact that Zeus continued punishing by extending that punishment to Prometheus's brother. Prometheus's brother. There's that guy, I can't pronounce his name. Epimetheus, I think. Epimetheus. All right. His brother. We're going to call him Epi. You got that? We're just going to call him Epi from here on out. Well, old Epi was the brother of Prometheus. Zeus was so offended by this secret that was shared to mankind that the punishment extended to his brother as well, who was innocent. But it was a devious punishment. Zeus fashioned a woman, and he had all the other gods participate by giving that woman something, made her super beautiful. Because according to the Greek traditions at this time, there were no females. The entire world was Titans and human males. Now, I know it sounds weird, but this is just the way the Greek tradition came down to us. I think they got it wrong, but I think that's a little too much patriarchal overtones that crept into the narrative. But that's okay. The punishment extended to Epi. Epi received a present from Zeus. Highly devious. This present was this absolutely goddess beautiful mortal woman named Pandora. So Pandora has the best of all gods, creations put into her. And her name actually means, Pandora actually means all gifts. But this is deceitful. So this is also a clue to the nature of Zeus. So after Pandora was accepted by Epi, Zeus sent her a jar and told her, under no circumstances, open that jar. You know damn well mortal's going to open that jar. You know we are absolutely, completely programmed to do the exact opposite of what we're told. You know we are. Hell, I'm an errant. I know I'm going to do the opposite of what I'm told. So, yeah, I learned by experience. I can have 10 wise men all telling me something in front of me, and Jason's going to go do it anyway. And then I'm going to be wiser for it, because I'm going to know you told me the truth, and I'm going to know exactly what the consequences are after I did it, no matter how dumb it is. So, where are we at? So she's told not to open it. But of course, Pandora opens it. And this is the play on words here. Pandora means all gifts. But it wasn't talking about all the gifts the gods gave to make her more and more beautiful. It was talking about all the gifts Zeus was giving mankind through a female who was going to disobey him. So she did that. She opened the lid, and all the woes and ailments, war, torment, misery, disease, everything negative in the human experience now came out of the jar, filled the world, and woman got blamed for it. So Zeus isn't who you think he is. But this Greek account is no different than what the Hebrew writers did when they were going through the Babylonian archives and libraries, and they put together the book of Genesis, for they did the same thing. They invented a woman named Eve. Eve means mother of all living, and they did the same thing. They had her eat a forbidden fruit. She was told not to eat of the tree of knowledge, and she did. The tree of knowledge here is no different than the vase. The jar contained something that Pandora would be curious about. The tree contained something that Eve would be curious about. I'm not saying Pandora's real. I'm not saying Eve is real. I'm saying that concepts are being married here by institutions in the ancient world that were one, basically fighting a war against matriarchy from a patriarchal perspective, and two, that were applying concepts to memories and turning them into pronouns. We're talking about events in the ancient world, not people. So, Zeus did this and blamed the jar, the container, for releasing all these things into the world. But that's not true. All these things already exist. And the hint of that is in Genesis as well. Because we already know that the existence of a tree of knowledge of good and evil absolutely admits that good and evil both existed before Eve ever disobeyed. So the hint of what was really being talked about here is that there was an ancient cataclysm. There was a cataclysm in the ancient world that did humanity bad. They were hiding underground for a long period of time. They came back up and instantly got set upon by something that started molding their history and blaming humans for the very conditions that they were living in. Something nefarious, something that was inside this world that wanted humans to blame themselves for what it itself had done. This is where I'm going. So, the elements of the Titan narrative, I'm going to read this to you. The elements of the Titan narrative reveal that both humankind opened up a container that released something new and dreadful into the world. And this also allowed for humans to be the subject of repeated destructions. But a benefactor had given mankind a key, and this key connected to hope. Remember, in the bottom of the jar, hope still remained. Everything evil came out the jar, but she shut that lid and there was still hope inside. So, to hope, which must be so powerful that the God of this world has done everything it can to stop succeeding generations from learning what that secret is that was shared by Prometheus. So terrible are these attempts to eradicate this secret that humans have had to hide in the underworld somewhere in the West multiple times. So Pandora's box is actually Pandora's jar. Humanity initiated something they could not contain. This is the introduction. Zeus is AIX. Zeus is artificial intelligence X. Greek myths lead us back to an event that looks just like our future. A destroyed world, basically reborn. Need to bring this to your attention. So, taking into consideration that this history of the Titans is a vast gulf for which we don't have much information, but the information that is contained, that we do have, passed on down to us, is painting a picture of humans hiding in the underworld, of humans receiving a secret from a benefactor who paid a great price. Yeah, of a system that has been implemented to blame mankind for its own condition. This is what the Greeks are conveying to us in their traditions of the Titans. This is what we find. So, now things begin to make sense to us. What was this secret? I believe that we can ascertain a good idea as to what Prometheus shared with ancient man just by what we know that happened in that pre-flood period. In that pre-flood period, mankind became obsessed with countdowns. I know some of you just had a light bulb go off in your head. Countdowns, sophisticated mathematical constructs that counted days and years to some future event when something was going to occur that was so important to humanity that this benefactor had sacrificed himself to make sure mankind got this information. And then in order to make sure that mankind could preserve this information, they encoded it in mathematical constructs that would last for eons, knowing that people would never forget a calendar. Listen, the 1,656-year pre-flood calendar of 138-year intervals of the Phoenix phenomenon is preserved in so many different ways that I have shown on my channel in my published books. I'm not going to re-itemize them here, but keep in mind this is one that's from the ancient world, and that repetition of 1656-year periods I've shown in charts goes all the way into our near future. The 600-year period of the Anunnaki Nur chronology is another calendar. They were obsessed with the 600-year period, knowing that when the end of that calendar came, it began a countdown to a specific series of events. The end of that calendar was 1962. Now, they also knew that the 6,000-year cycle was prevalent. They preserved that. It's in Zoroastrian writings. We have the 6,000 years as a repetition of the 2,000-3,000-year great ages of Theopompus. The biblical 6,000 years, six days of creation, one day of rest. Each day of creation in the biblical eschatology is supposed to be 1,000 years. We have the Judeo-Christian concept of a 6,000-year countdown to the return of a god to this world. Now, that's preserved. The Mayan long count calendar, never have we ever seen a mathematical construct that has been so well preserved. It's been misunderstood, but it's been reconstructed and put back together. And I've showed you this many times. 1,872,000 turnings of the stars, all the way from 3113 BC, is 13 baktons. Each one's 144,000 days. The entire Mayan long count started during this vapor canopy period, during the reign of Enoch, who is said in ancient texts to be the greatest chronologist that has ever lived, also a mathematician and an architect. This calendar counts down to November 2046. Just like the base diagonals of the Great Pyramid's geometrical timeline, according to David Davidson in 1924, as I've shown many times, ends with the final year being 2045 and 2046 being year one of a whole new epoch. So, the fascination of timekeeping systems suddenly appeared all at the same time in the ancient world. And I have charts that show you. I have whole charts that just itemize calendars and show you how they all start at the same 21-year window and all move into the future, and how most of them end right here in between 2040 and 2106 AD. Whatever Prometheus told mankind, it was something to do with fire. But the greatest architectural project the world has ever seen was also initiated during the vapor canopy, and it's the Great Pyramid. And if you remember correctly, pyramid means fire in the middle. And I do believe that concludes my presentation. And I know some light bulbs went off in some of your heads. I have no doubt about that. But I guess we do have time for Q&A. I got done with that presentation a lot faster than I was anticipating. But that is, and so I'll sum it up in one minute. The Legends of the Titans preserve basic historical elements that a benefactor appeared, gave mankind something they really needed to know. It has something to do with the pyramid, and it has everything to do with not having to hide in the underworld anymore, being able to stop whatever this phenomenon is and escape from this diabolical entity that masquerades as different gods.
Now we're going to get into this book, Secret of the Ages. His name is Brinsley Lenfour Crench. He cites some really, really compelling authors, really interesting research. We're getting right into this, guys. Those of you who have watched my Archaics movie, you're going to see some parallels here, which is astonishing. This man wrote this in 1974 based off a lot of older books. One of them we'll be reading whole passages from. We're gonna start right now. This is about the Titans, the history of the Titans and the giants and the Greek gods. He's pulling this information from an author named H.A. Yorber in a book called The Myths of Greece and Rome. Right here, The Myths of Greece and Rome. This is where he's pulling this data from. This is amazing material. So, referring to the children of Gaia and Uranus, heaven, which is supposed to be earth and heaven, he wrote, they had not dwelt long on the summit of Mount Olympus before they found themselves the parents of 12 gigantic children, whose strength was such that their father Uranus greatly feared them. To prevent their ever making use of it against him, he seized them immediately after their birth, hurled them down into a dark abyss called Tartarus, and there chained them fast. These giants were called Titans, and we still use the word Titanic to describe something of vast size. Thus, early did the giant appear in world legends. This chasm was situated far under the earth, and Uranus knew that his sons, Oceanus, Poeas, Prius, Hyperion, Iapetus, and Cronus, as well as his six daughters, the Titanides, Ilia, Rhea, Themis, Thetis, I can't pronounce that, Mnemosyne, and Phoebe, could not easily escape from its cavernous depth. There are constant references throughout Greek mythology to Tartarus or Hades, a place far down under the earth, the prison house of the lower world. It is part of our argument that Atlantis existed and that the gods of Greek mythology were originally the kings of Atlantis, later dividing ten kingdoms and made up the whole empire between them, under the overall rule of Zeus. The Atlantic area was given to Poseidon, after whom the island of Poseidonius was named, and the underworld was given to Pluto. What he's describing here is a division of the land, the same thing we find in the Semitic traditions that happened with Noah. Noah got Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Japheth is named after Iapetos, the Titan right here, named here. And it was called the drawing of the lots, and they drew for their lots, and Shem got the middle of the earth, Iapetos got the east and north, and Hades got the south and far west. So, Kim. You know him in the Bible, his name is Ham. So it's the same story told right here, but this was done among the Titans. So he makes the argument here that the ancient writers believed that the lots were given, real allotments, real geographical areas were given. So why all of a sudden the switch by the religionists that the underworld was not a real geographical place where civilization existed? But all of a sudden it's a spiritual place where spirits go when they're doomed. This isn't the ancient interpretation. This was a modern religionist interpretation imposed upon an older belief. So the author says, I consider the hollow earth to be a fact. And in the second part of this book, I will set before you up-to-date modern and scientific proof. At this stage, we can well study the frequent mention of Tartarus in the legends. It is appreciated that mythology is not a collection of facts, but of myths. However, behind all these stories, there may well lie something close to the truth, something so devastating that our own conceptions of the geography of the earth will have to be revised. It is not necessary to go into Greek mythology too deeply here. Suffice it to state that Cronos escaped from Tartarus with the aid of his mother, Gaia, and overcame his father, Uranus, while asleep. He then set free his brothers and sister and became the new king. His father had cursed him, foretelling that one day he, Cronos, would in turn be supplanted by his own children. The time came when his wife, Rhea, gave birth to a son. When Rhea offered him the baby to hold, Cronos, recollecting his father's curse, swallowed the child while Rhea looked on in horror. Each time Rhea had a child, it would meet with the same fate. Finally, when Zeus, her youngest, was born, he decided to trick her husband. She placed a large stone in swaddling clothes and offered it to Cronos, who swallowed it. Meanwhile, Rhea had arranged for Zeus to be looked after by the Melian nymph, who hid him in a cave of Mount Ida. This is the mountain of the shepherd. Subsequently, when Zeus was a grown man, he attacked and overcame his father in a terrible struggle. Cronos was given a special potion prepared by Metis, daughter of Oceanus. This caused him to vomit up the children and the stone that had been swallowed. Zeus gave his sisters and brothers a share of his domain, and some of the Titans, notably Oceanus, Hyperion, and Themis, gave their allegiance to the new king. However, the others would not have Zeus as their king, and so began a terrible conflict, the revolt of the Titans. The Titans began a furious attack on Mount Olympus. Zeus, realizing that he was outnumbered, released the Cyclopes and the Hecatoncheires. I believe this. It's Hecate and Cheires, meaning hands. Hecatoncheires, who had also been languishing in Tartarus. The Cyclopes agreed to let him have thunderbolts, weapons which they knew how to make. The author says, there is something here very reminiscent of 20th century warfare. And the Hecatoncheires put their 100-handed arms at Zeus's disposal. We have here an authority on the surface world who needs help in a war, who's outmatched, and all of a sudden, he receives reinforcements from the underworld, from people who actually were formerly not just banished, but they were banished and they were set aside. They weren't allowed to come to the surface. Now all of a sudden they're allowed as long as they join the war. So I am wondering if this story has not got a little distorted while being passed on to us by the ancient Greeks, who did not have the modern weapons that we do today. He's talking about frames of reference. The ancients were passing on legends of their gods who lived thousands of years before them. This is pure speculation, but I am wondering if the Hecatoncheires had not got the ability to construct something like giant tanks, which were armed with 100 guns or 100 weapons. The number means 100 hands, so or 100 arms. Arms is an old Arms is an old term also for weapons. So the war lasted for 10 years. Zeus himself took part hurling thunderbolts incessantly. He got these from the Cyclopes. The Titans were eventually overcome, and some of them were flung back into Tartarus. Zeus had scarcely overcome the Titans when he found himself involved in another conflict. Another war erupted, and this time it was against the giants. These giants had apparently been conceived, according to the story, from the blood of the mutilated Uranus. I shall have some ideas of my own to give you later about this in the book. These new giants were terrible to behold. They had legs like serpents, and their feet consisted of the heads of snakes. They attacked Mount Olympus in force, tearing up mountains and piling them one upon the other. However, the Olympians stood their ground, but it was eventually due to a semi-divine mortal, Hercules, who managed to defeat the giant, Alcyoneus. That the battle was won. It is very important to note that these particular giants were monstrous mutants. Finally, Gaia made one more effort on behalf of her Titan children. According to the Larousse Encyclopedia of Mythology, Gaia, however, could not resign herself to the defeat of her children. Against Zeus, he raised up a final monster. Typhon, whom she had born in Tartarus. This isn't me saying this. This author is citing an old book found in an old French library that talks about this ancient tradition that the goddess literally is the origin of Phoenix. The Typhon weapon, and it was because of Zeus. What we have here is a matriarchal society at war and losing against a patriarchal takeover. This is what is being described here. This is what I've been describing on my channel since day one with all my goddess videos and videos on sibyls. These are a lot of my older videos. I know some of you new to my channel aren't familiar. A lot of my older videos go into the goddess and the vapor canopy civilizations. So this is what we have here. It says right here in Greek tradition that Typhon, the phoenix, was specifically made by Gaia, the goddess, and she unleashed it against Zeus and his kingdom. It says right here that Typhon was made in the underworld. Remember, guys, in many of my presentations, I've showed you the evidence that these super constructions in the sky are controlled by underworld technologies, that the UFO phenomenon is misdirection, and all this stuff about extraterrestrial and extraterrestrial, this is a very ancient deceit. It's also his conclusion, guys. This is why my publisher sent this book. Look to the book. UFOs from inside the Earth. I told you on my channel many times, there is no documentation of UFOs going in and out the atmosphere. None. They are all seen coming up and down from valleys, mountains, and bodies of water. Many UFOs have been reported by militaries all around the world as being underwater. Yeah, he makes the same conclusions. He even says in this book, two different places, he says, it looks like that the entire phenomenon is misdirection, that something in the underworld wants us to believe that all this phenomena is caused in a real sky. This guy opened my eyes up to the shape of the simulation as well. Oh yeah, oh yeah. It's not just a flat plane. He goes deep into all the Arctic and the Antarctic. Expeditions. I've read things in this book I've never heard before, but they make absolute sense. I've heard about explorers that went to the Arctic and came across a warm ocean and came across mammalian life forms where they're not even supposed to exist, and plants and pollens and red dust that blankets the ice, and all these things were known in the 1890s when the Arctic and the Antarctic were being explored. And man, I had no idea. This book right here has really opened my mind to a lot, but it's so good to read these confirmations about the archaic conclusions that I've been telling you guys about in all my research. But right here, he is convinced there is an underworld civilization trying to deceive us into believing UFO activity is coming from interstellar, and it's not. It's not. Every bit of it's coming from, this is technology being used in the underworld. He infers earthquakes, volcanoes, the Phoenix phenomenon is the result of technology being used against the surface world by underworlders. That's this book. It's amazing. Let's continue. There's more revelations here. So, first of all, this is what the author says. There is no such person as Tartarus. Tartarus is not a pronoun for the name of a person. There is no such person as Tartarus. It is the name of the underworld prison, sometimes called Hades. The above quotation is a clear indication that this Typhon was manufactured in the underworld. You got to read this book. At first, Zeus stood firm against the dreadful monster, but he was taken prisoner by Typhon and kept captive in Cilicia. After being rescued by Hermes, Zeus finally overcame the monster by using his thunderbolts with great skill. After this peace came to the world, Zeus was now fully in command. Zeus didn't defeat anything. The Phoenix phenomenon is only temporary. It lasts a few hours in one day. So after this peace came to the world, Zeus was now truly in command. As mentioned earlier, he divided up his realm between his brothers and looked after all these areas as a kind of supreme emperor. This was the problem. It was a patriarchal takeover of matriarchal societies. And the ones that were, this new patriarchal power had come straight up from the underworld. It is the story of the Anunna and the Sumerians all over again. It's the exact same story. So, yeah, it blows my mind how incredible all that was. So, we're going to move to this next part that he talks about, which is fascinating. I've got it marked. Oh, let's go to page 63. Yeah, guys, I read several of these passages twice. So, the author says, this is the author's conclusions. He says, there are many references in classical mythology, the Bible, and in folklore of various races to an underworld, variously called Hades, Hell, and Tartarus. It's even called Hell in the Norse tradition. It is my contention that this lower world is a very real and it is very physical, and its occupants exert a tremendous influence upon surface dwellers today. Yeah, he said this in 1974, basing his conclusions off of older books he was studying. So let's go to page 68 and 69. So this right here blew my mind when I said, he spends two or three chapters explaining that all these ancient traditions were talking about a physical underworld inhabited by physical beings. And often these fairies and all that, they were considered enchanted and magical. And it's not. They're technologically advanced. That's his conclusions too. He says, another interesting point concerns Jesus. It will be recalled that according to the Bible, just prior to his ascension, Jesus descended into hell. Remember, we're told in the New Testament that the Word was going to be spread over the entire world, to all races, to all tongues, to all men. Why wouldn't Jesus go descend into the underworld? It was later said, over 100-something years later, it was said in one of the Christian letters of Paul that Jesus descended into the underworld to go preach to angels that rebelled and all that stuff. But that may not be true. That could all be interpolation. He went to a physical place. It might have been Shambhala. It might have been Agartha. It might have been whatever the underworld, Niflheim, which is the underworld of the Norse. And hell is a compartment of it. Well, yeah, it's all. It could have been. It's just, it's amazing when you think about it. It's like, wow. The Logos would have spread the word, giving the message of the Oversoul to all men, like he did, and then turn around. When he disappeared, it wasn't a crucifixion. This was all Christian myth and legend based off the legend of Mithras, the sun god who was crucified. There's like 19 different ancient sun gods that were all crucified. This is what the church did. They imposed that on Jesus. But there's in the original Gospel of Marcion, there is no crucifixion. There's no, none of that's there. Jesus disappeared after his message was over, he disappeared. Well, according to the New Testament, he went to the underworld. He went to Hades. That's very interesting. The author says there is no doubt that the ancient Greeks and other nations believed in an actual, real, physical underworld. Later on, theologists regarded it as a non-physical plane you might be dispatched to after death instead of heaven if you did not come up to scratch. If you did not, I guess that's an old colloquial I'm not familiar with. If you did not come up to scratch, something different. I'm not really familiar with that. So the last thing I want to read out of this book, the last thing I want to bring to your attention is this amazing little passage right here. It says that, he literally says on page 69 that the stories of the ancients, the stories of the Greek mythology, the Titans and the giants and all, he says, we're given a picture that there was a great cataclysm and people had fled from their mother country, hoping to escape from the catastrophe, and they survived on the surface to give us our present civilization. Most of them, however, took refuge in the tunnel systems connecting with the hollow earth, and their descendants are still there today, living in fabulous cities inside of our planet. Edens, walled enclosures. Where is that reference? I can't believe I missed that reference. There's a reference in here to the four rivers of hell. I might have skipped over, man. I might have skipped a whole page here. Giants, snakes, Tash, Tartarus, and Thunderbolts. I guess I might have missed that. But he goes in there and shows that the four rivers of Eden have never been located on the surface world. The four rivers fed into Eden. Eden was a walled enclosure. Mankind, those who are on the surface world, were banished to go scratch out their existence and suffering on the surface. They were kicked out of the walled enclosure, which is what Eden means. It's a paradise. But his interpretation, which I'm buying, is that Eden was never on the surface. Eden was the fabulous paradise world in the underworld. Technologically advanced, everything is there. Everything in the dark light, everything grows fantastic. He talks about that in here too, the different types of green luminescent bacteria that have been found that give off light in cave systems that plants can grow by. He talks about that in here. It's just a fascinating book because it touches on so many different archaic concepts, and it wasn't trying to, because all this research was done before I was born. This book was published in 1974. I was born in 1973. He didn't read and write all that in 1 year. This man had been researching many things for many years before I was born. And my publisher found this old book, and he sent it to me. And it's just amazing. The story of Greek mythology concerning the Titans and the Giants was a war when a civilization from the underworld came up after a cataclysm and found the goddess worshiping matriarchal civilization still intact, although they were spread out and they didn't have the technology that had been preserved in the underworld. And there was a great contest to see who was going to win out. And the goddess got mad, whoever the goddess is. The goddess got mad at this patriarchal takeover and used some of the same technology that was used in the war and unleashed the Phoenix. The Phoenix causes periodic resets on surface civilizations, and yet doesn't seem to penetrate to the underworld. Now I think I know why. Because the Phoenix is underworld technology. I've told you guys from the beginning, the sky is a lie. All that phenomena is being caused by machinery and different types of technological things far more sophisticated than we understand today that are being operated and controlled by underworlders. Just like those UFOs I told you guys, they expand, they contract, they elongate, they move erratically. These are not vehicles, they're range finders. Remember, they open up a dimensional envelope, and if there's any material objects or people nearby or cattle or animals or something, that dimensional envelope, when they collapse it, they can literally teleport somebody above the surface into the underworld. Those UFOs are range finders. That's why they act erratic around planes and vehicles. And yeah, there's somebody in the underworld looking through that and trying to hone in. This is what happens. And they seem to be very good at it in the Bermuda Triangle and the Devil's Triangle off the coast of Japan. But in other areas of the world, they're not. But I don't want to make this video unnecessarily long. This video was a presentation about the Titans, and that it conveys a much deeper meaning and deeper history. This guy brought a lot of value to the Archaics database, a lot, and a whole new understanding of the origin of the Phoenix and why the Phoenix can be both a destroyer and a benefactor protocol. It depends upon your perspective. It depends upon who the good guys are. But it looks like we on the surface are not only the descendants of the losers of an ancient war, that war is not over with yet.